I want to welcome you this on this wonderful, beautiful, rainy day that we have here on November 20th, 2008. And what I would like to let you know, we had a conflict in scheduling. We had, our committee had planned this back in September, and Ways and Means decided they wanted to have a meeting and didn't check to see that we had this scheduled. And two of our members, Senator Gordley and Senator Carter, are on the Ways and Means. And so they said they would be coming back and forth because they're needed over there with the budget and everything that's going and the information that they're getting there as well as here. And a lot of what we're covering here is a start of what we're going to be doing in the 09 session. So I think our prayers and thoughts need to be with Senator Morissette, whose wife is in ICU right now, and they're doing tests and trying to figure out what is happening there. And Senator Cruz says he'll be here in a couple of minutes, and I hope he's on my committee next interim. And so you have the two most important people here listening to you, okay? All right. With that, I would like to open an informational meeting on adolescent substance abuse treatment and the summit report that they're having. Here's Senator Cruz. And Senator Cruz, I just told everyone that the two most important people in health care for the Senate next 09 session are you and me. And so because we're short on people.
Well, and it was interesting, Madam Chair, that you said you had requested me to be on your committee because I requested to be on your committee.
Oh, well, so. Good. It's a mutual admiration society up here. All right. From the audience, you can make comments when you're at the dais. All righty. With that, I have a very strong interest in adolescent substance abuse. I was a former public health nurse, and I actually spent work at the Oregon City High School as their clinic nurse at their school-based health center. And know that there was a problem back then in the early 90s when I worked at Oregon City High School and then as a public health nurse. And then when you're reading stories about the abuse that's going on our college campuses, et cetera, it's an issue that we really need to address. And I know that we have had some wonderful people working on this issue. And so this is the start of where maybe we as a legislature can go in addressing the adolescent drinking problem in this state. And with that, I would like to call Gina Nickel, Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, to start this whole show off.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson, committee member. For the record, my name is Gina Nickel, and I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And I'm pleased to be here today. This is a subject that is really dear to my heart, and we know that we need to spend some time on this. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Today with us we have Vanessa Frias and Shailene Turner, and they are two individuals in recovery who are going to share a little bit about their treatment experiences. Donna Lovemday is going to comment on the significance of family involvement and family participation in the treatment program, and then Sheila North will talk a little bit about the challenges of adolescent substance abuse treatment, and she's a provider. First, let me provide you with an overview of adolescent addiction and Oregon's plan to reduce this growing problem. As you know, Senator, you've been involved with us in all the way many aspects and attended the leadership summit, which we really appreciate. And Senator Cruz and I have talked for years about this subject, and we know that there are going to be cuts this next session, but we want to explain to you a little bit why substance abuse treatment for adolescents is so important. To prevent this lifelong addictions, programs for adolescents should be accessible, developmentally appropriate, and structured. to support the needs of individuals as they transition to adulthood. On January 31st, 2008, a group of Oregon professionals met to review advances piloted by the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment. That's CSAT, for those that know it by that name. These professionals also measured Oregon's strengths and needs with regard to these advances. Using the new strategic development direction by CSAT, the summit participants developed recommendations for five overarching areas: interagency collaboration, finance organization, workforce development, dissemination of evidence-based practices, and family involvement, and provided for you as a copy of that adolescent treatment summit report. According to the 2007 U.S. Census, there are about 305,000 youth ages 12 to 17 old living in Oregon. About 75% or 20,000 of these youth there's about 26,000 that actually need treatment. About 14,000 are not getting the treatment that they need. Oregon treated 572 youth in residential treatment abuse and 5,897 youth in outpatient treatment.
Say those numbers again, Gina.
Oregon treated 572 youth in residential substance abuse treatment and 5,897 youth in outpatient treatment.
Okay. Thank you.
Of those, 10% were treated for alcohol, 30% were treated for illicit drug use, and 70% for both alcohol and illicit drug use. The top three drugs prior to entering treatment: marijuana, 54%, alcohol, 28%, and methamphetamines, 9%. Oregon contracts for 71 residential beds at a cost of $161 per day, with the average length of stay of about 80.6 days. The cost of outpatient services is anywhere from about $2,500 to $4,500, with an average of a length of stay of about 161 days. Substance abuse treatment works, and I know you've heard before that substance abuse treatment does not work. I want to dispel that myth. It does work. And the outcomes provided by the Addictions and Mental Health Division show reduced uses of substances, increased academic performance, and reduction in arrests. And who you're going to hear from right now is going to be just a little snippet into their world of what it was like before when they were using, and now that they're clean and sober. And I think that the evidence will speak for itself. I'd like to thank this committee for looking at the data. We provided you with some data. The summit was absolutely wonderful. It will give you a glimpse into what we need to do this system. Please do not make cuts in this program that is already so underfunded. With that, we're going to bring Shay and Vanessa up here, and I think their mothers are going to be here for support, too.
Great. All right. With that, I would like to call, thank you, Gina. We'd like to call Shalene Turner and Vanessa Frias. Okay, if you maybe wanted to go one at a time so that the moms can sit in the chair, so whoever will be first, then that would be great. And please introduce yourself to us.
Hi, I'm Shaylin Turner, and I'm 16 years old and attend Bournemouth High School. I was at Yes House for 6 months in residential treatment for alcohol and marijuana use. In the beginning of my addiction, it was all for fun. It was kind of in the way I was raised, so I just thought it was normal. I was born into an addict family, and after a while, after I turned 12, a whole bunch of issues came up with my family. My parents got a divorce, and that was really hard on the family. My brother went to residential treatment as well, and both my parents started using. My mom used to come home drunk, and I remember her asking me if she was being a good mom, and it switched roles between us. Like, I was the mom taking care of her. And my dad, when he was drinking, he became really depressed and suicidal. And so after a while of living through that, my easing became to cope. And I got 2 MIPs, and that's why I got put on probation in the first place. I was 13 years old when I got my first one, and a year later I got my second one. I got alcohol poisoning and had to ride in an ambulance to the hospital to get my stomach pumped. And after that scared my family, and it was pretty scary for me too. But so I just decided, you know, I'd quit drinking. So after a while, I just started smoking marijuana, and I would smoke with my brothers or whoever was around. Eventually, I was giving my probation officer dirty U.S., and I would get natural consequences along with that. Hours of community service were true, and my mom tried to help out by getting home U.S., and yet I just continued to use. I eventually ended up on drug court, which is like Star Court in Salem, and I still kept using. I was numb and I didn't care. I just wanted to get stoned. That was really all I was after. And I ended up going to Yes House because I knew I wasn't going to be able to quit if I didn't go to residential treatment. And so before that, when I was 12, I remember my brother, he was in probation and he was in drug court, and he went to Yes House. And I remember going to a family group to support him there, and all of the other clients there told me, you know, you keep doing the things you're doing and hanging out with the people you're hanging out with, you're going to end up right where your brother was. And I never really believed them because, you know, they were just a few years older than I was. And so I thought it was pretty ironic 3 years later, and I'm in the exact seat as my brother. I gave up a lot for smoking pot. I gave up my family and being an all-star on the basketball and volleyball team just for smoking pot. Mm-hmm. And I really lost who I was. I lost my honesty, my values, and many other things that came along with that. I learned many things at residential treatment. I learned that my actions really do affect people around me, especially the people who care and love and want to be there to support me. It took a lot for me to realize that the first month when I was in residential treatment, I ran away. And I remember after 3 days, I came back and saw how disappointed and scared and how much hurt and pain I caused my family. So that was the big motivator for me, you know, to actually want to change. My values and goals have come back into order. I played basketball. I made the JV basketball team. And I gave that up when I started smoking pot and drinking. Also, there's 4 phases in drug court, and I'm on phase 3, and that's been quite an accomplishment for me, too. I have many coping skills now that help me not to use. I like to write my journal, and I go to drug and alcohol counseling and other groups that are outside of probation and drug court. I go to Al-Anon meetings and NA meetings as well. One thing that I would say that really helped me through treatment was family support. I'm really thankful that I've gotten a gift to go to residential treatment, because I know if I didn't go, then I don't think I would have been able to quit. I don't have the tools or anything to help me get through it. And by going into residential with family support behind me, then I really felt like I wasn't in it alone. And for an addict, you know, it's really scary, because when you go to residential treatment or any type of treatment, they tell you that if you really want to change, you have to change everything. And having to change everything and all by yourself, that's just a scary thought. And so having family support, I would say, was one of the biggest things that really got me through it. Right now, like I said, I'm playing basketball again, and I'm working in a school, and I'm a sophomore, and all my family right now, we're all in recovery. Now my mom's been clean for 2.5 years, and so has my father. They're back together, and my life just seems so much more put together ever since I've been out of treatment. Now I can honestly say that, yeah, my mom is a wonderful mom, and I'm really thankful for having her and her being there for me through it all. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. That's a powerful story. How many years, or how long have you now been clean, you yourself?
264 days.
264 days.
Counting.
Awesome. Yay. Yes, Senator.
Yeah.
Cruz.
First off, disclosure, I'm also in recovery. So it's been 23 years, I think, something like that. But one of the things when I was in treatment, the young people that would come into treatment, I mean, when you're young, you're bulletproof. Okay. And you kind of spoke to that when people were saying, if you don't stop, you're going to end up here yourself. And so you just think, no, not me. But so was there a point when you're in treatment or something where, I mean, for me, there was a point in treatment where there was a total epiphany, and I understood what I was. Was there some kind of point for you that brought it all home to you and changed your thinking about this?
Yeah, like the treatment work that I got when I was in residential, or just talking about like why I started using it in the first place. Like, it was for fun, and then eventually it became to cope, and then it eventually just became a habit, and a habit that I couldn't quit. And I didn't, you know, everything. My mind just got really cloudy, that I didn't really see any values or goals why I would want to quit. And so once I went to residential, like, I had a certain amount of time clean. My mind became clear, and my values came back in order. And forgiveness was one thing that really helped me, like, change my mind. And forgiving my family and myself.
Yeah. I would have put it in the other order. You got to forgive yourself first. But, yeah, okay. This is wonderful. I'm a big supporter of Teen Drug Court as well. I think that's a structure that will prove to work over time. We've done a lot with adult drug court, and we need to move that model forward. I know a lot of counties are exploring it now. It's young people are tougher. They truly are. By the time you get to the age I was when I quit, I had been beat down a hell of a lot. But and then run out of options. But, you know, the fact that kids are resilient and think they can survive anything. And, I mean, I admire your ability to do this at such a young age. There are a whole lot of us that had to go through a whole lot more hell than you will have to. So a year is amazing. Actually, for me, the most amazing chip I ever got was the 15-day one. Okay, it truly was. The fact that I could be clean for 15 days just blew me away. But keep up the good work. You know, life is so much better. Truly is.
Does the mother want to have any words, or are you here for moral support? And please state your name.
I'm Lori, Shailene's mom. And I just feel so blessed that hearing the statistics, hearing some children got a bed out of how many that did outpatient. Shailene did outpatient, and she was doing really well a year before she ended up inpatient. And I just can't stress enough how important that I feel like the funds need to stay for the young kids, because, like you said, if the funds stay there and you treat the disease before it progresses, because it's a progressive disease, and if you can treat it in the beginning stages. Why wouldn't, you know, why wouldn't the funds be there? Because maybe there wouldn't be so much funds needed for the older people. I don't know. That's just the way that I think. I went through treatment in 87. I didn't keep my program. And when I needed to get sober again, I did know what to do. You know, I moved out of the house. Her dad moved in and took care of the kids. And I knew what I needed to do. I needed time out. I needed to take a week vacation. And I needed to go to a lot of meetings. So I can't say enough about the treatment facilities because there's a part where it's progressed enough where that's the only thing that's going to work.
And this is a story we really need to get to all the other legislators to so that they see how important this is, especially when there are such beautiful success stories like you are.
Yeah. I think she brings a good point. It's, the treatment is absolutely critical and crucial. It's what you do after treatment and the connections you make. And like you said, you fell off the program, but you knew where to go back. Okay, you knew where the support was, and that's one thing we say in 12-step programs: the crime isn't walking away; the crime's not coming back. Mm-hmm. So, and we don't put enough emphasis on the aftercare, the 12-step work, because that for me, 12-step programs are the thing that got me through my insanity when I first got sober. So,
thank you, Senator Cruz. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kim.
Hey, Vanessa.
Hi, I'm Vanessa, and this is my mom, Margarita. I'm 14, and I go to Crescent Valley High School. Before treatment, my life was out of control. At 12, I started smoking marijuana, and by 13, I had gotten drunk for the first time. And I stole my grandma's car and drove to school, and I picked up my best friend, and we crashed, and she was hurt. And after that, just everything just went crazy. I was skipping school to go get high. My grades dropped completely. I stopped playing sports. I wasn't talking to my parents. I wasn't talking to anybody. I felt like I needed male attention to make me feel important. I ran away from my mom. I ran away to not deal with confrontations with the law, the school, and my family. I didn't talk to anybody because all everyone could tell me was, you need to do something different. You have a problem with us. You need to get help. And I was like, no, I don't. I'm fine. Everything's under control. I got it. Everything's okay. And I was in and out of juvenile hall. I was put in a youth shelter, which I got kicked out of for having drugs. And I just didn't care about anything. I thought everything was all a game. I thought life was a game. I just stopped caring about everything. And then once I got put into treatment, I got tricked into going there. And I didn't talk to her for a while after I got put in there. I hated her. I was like, I can't believe you did that to me. Why would you do that? When I got there, I didn't listen to the counselors. The clients were like, you gotta listen, or else you're not gonna get out of here. You're gonna be stuck here. And I was like, no, I'm not. I'm getting out of here. I don't want to do this. And my mom's like, come on, Vanessa, please, please do this. You need this. And I was like, no, I don't. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't need to be here. And I just got fed up with everyone telling me that I needed help, and I ran away twice. And every time I came back, I was numb. I hated everything. I hated life. I was scared. I was lonely, and I didn't know what I had to do to make it better. And just kind of gave up. Scared of what might happen. And after coming back, my mom started coming more. She went to groups, and she had counseling sessions with me, and she brought my sister and my brother. And one of the groups, my brother's like, when are you coming home? And I said, I don't know. And at that point, I was like, when am I going to go home? When is this going to get better? I don't like this. I don't want to do it anymore. And then I just was like, I got to do this. I need this. And I started paying attention to my treatment work. And I actually started listening to what my counselor had to say. And I was like, no, that's true. That is true. And I couldn't really, you know, do. And finally, I asked for help. And the help was there. And I was so happy that my mom started coming with me. And it's like, oh, yeah, this is where this feels a lot better. And once I started listening and I opened up and I allowed myself to be vulnerable and ask for help and admit that I was scared and that I really wanted to go home, then everything just went a lot easier.
Vanessa, how long did it take in the treatment before you started seeing that you really wanted help?
4 months.
Really?
I would do good for a certain amount of time, like a month and a half. I would do good. I was like, yeah, I got this. It's good. And then just something always came up, and I didn't know how to handle it. And I'd end up running away, or running away from my house, or relapsing. It just didn't work until I finally, I do need help, and I do want to go home. And at that point, treatment was a lot easier. I felt better. And I actually got to spend time with my family, and spending time with them helped me realize that I do want to be home, and that's where I need to be. And my mom coming and supporting me made me feel better about treatment. And we live in Colorado, and so the treatment center was there, and so she was able to come see me very often, and so that was good. That helped me a lot too. And once I got out of, towards the end of my treatment stay, it was really good. I learned how to deal with, big problems rather than running away and being scared of everything and just hiding. And I learned how to stay strong and ask for help. And my mom was there for everything, and she helped me be strong. She's my rock for treatment. And once I got out of treatment, I didn't think it was going to be the same. I thought it was going to be, no, my life's going to be so different. And now, it's like, no, this is going to be easy now. And once I got out, it was hard. It was really hard. But my mom, Shay and I are group leaders of Alateen. We do that. I have drug corps. And so that helps too. They help me stay on top of everything and stuff. And once I got out of Yes House, I was talking to my mom more. I started talking to my counselor. I was just more open with how I was feeling, which helped a lot. I went to meetings at NAA and Alateen. Meetings helped a lot. And it was just, I think, family support was, the biggest thing. And it would be really hard to get through treatment without having my mom there supporting me. And seeing how her life's been so much better after she got out of treatment, seeing that she was happy after treatment, made me feel like, oh, I can't do it. I want to be there, too. I want to be happy after treatment. I want to make it work. And it did. Now, my eyes, it's pretty normal. It feels better feeling in control of me. And I'm a volleyball player. I play volleyball. And when I was using, I gave up sports and stuff and just kind of forgot about everything. And now it's just it's fun again. Sports is fun. And going to school, and it's I get to sit here and not really worry about that. Just get to be a kid again. I get to have fun and do school. And now, looking back on my old life, I see that it was scary and that it was hard and stuff. And what was really hard, looking in the mirror and seeing that person, knowing that that's not really who I really was, and now, well, I see me, I know that, like, this is the life I like, and whenever I feel myself, like, falling back, Yes House allows people to come back for meetings and stuff, and that's where I go.
Is the influence in your peers, because there's a lot of kids out there using,
yeah.
How does that affect you, having been through treatment? I can't help feel that, especially youth, you know, you do so many things with your peers and the influence that they have on you. How can you cope when there are those out there that may encourage you to start using again? What skills did you learn that prevent you from associating or using again with when your peers are?
I learned to say no and stand up for myself. And I knew that just once again, if I did it once where I started hanging out with friends again, that I'd get right back in to how it used to be. And I know that's not life I want.
And you don't want to. That's great.
Oh no, this is a little bit of deja vu for me.
Yeah. Does the mother have any words she'd like to say? Thank you for being there for her. That is so critical. You've got to have the family support, and not all kids have that. So you're blessed that way. Thank you very much. So appreciated both of your testimonies. Donna? Oh, Gina.
Just really quick, I wanted to say that Shay and Vanessa represent those lucky adolescents that get to be in residential treatment, and we need so much more. Now, Donna, love them day.
And just one question,
yes,
on that. Would there be any way to get information on what the waiting list is?
Absolutely. We'll get that to you.
I think that's important, too. And I know that there are so many out there, and maybe families just don't know about the treatment or are ashamed or we so need to get the word out, because when we have beautiful success cases like these two, we need to get that word out. So
absolutely. Yeah. I will get you those.
Also, Gina, because teen drug courts are a relatively new critter in the state, some information on those counties where it's up and running, those who are considering, and the roadblocks they have. I know that, like in Douglas County, one of the roadblocks is providers into the network to deal with the treatment side of it. It's a wonderful concept, and but there are some roadblocks for a lot of folks in trying to move forward with it. So information on that would be helpful as
Absolutely.
Well.
It would be nice if we can, in the 09 session, to know where the drug courts are, where they're working, and maybe how we can expand them. We need that information. We're not going to be able to go anywhere unless we have that kind of information before us.
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Cruz, I will not only get you that information, but get you some ideas of how you can fund it.
Okay. And we will need that this 09 session. I just met with the Senate President this morning, and they say, the economy is really bad. Don't ask for any more money. So, yeah.
With that, we're going to ask for more money.
So, Donna, I'm going to let her pronounce her name, but we practice it. Love 'em Day from Oregon Partnership is going to come out and talk about family participation and family education. And then Sheila North will wrap it up, and she's from DePaul Treatment Center, director there, a longtime provider, and going to talk a little bit about adolescent treatment from the provider perspective.
Okay, thank you.
Kind of cool, the new digs here, isn't it?
Yeah. Go ahead, introduce yourself. And
first, I apologize for looking like a wet rat.
No, that's all right. Or you're an Oregonian.
I'm lost in your parking garage. Well, Chair Monis Anderson. I'm Donna Labende, Education Director for Oregon Partnership. some of you, many of you may have already know who Oregon Partnership is. We're a, what we are is a statewide nonprofit organization that addresses prevention and combats alcohol and drug abuse in our state. Oregon Partnership partners with communities, with educators, schools, treatment providers, law enforcement, and families to provide prevention education and as well as the referral services to Oregon. We handle the state's crisis lines. And I appreciate the opportunity to comment on significance of family. The first thing I have to say is you just heard from two very brave young ladies,
yes.
Vanessa and Shannon, and their mothers, Lori and Margaret. Faces with names and personal stories, and that's the point. That's why we have them speak, is because when we refer to adolescent treatment and the need to bring together families, youth, and providers so they can learn from each other and design and implement effective treatment programs that work, we're talking about adolescents with names like Vanessa and Shailene, and we're talking about mothers like Margarita, I heard her daughter say, and Lori, who are willing to take the personal risk that comes with telling a very personal story. That was a very difficult story to listen to. And the sad thing is that story is being told and it's being lived throughout our state. And that's the point. That's why they're here. When we look at substance abuse and the need for adolescent treatment, we know there's a need for a systems change. We need a system that allows for family and youth voice. So the treatment system is responsive to the real needs of the families and youth. I know this personally because I have a son who is diagnosed with mental illness. My involvement as a parent made all the difference, all the difference. A system designed around real faces with real names and personal stories. All system development and implementation must be informed by integrating the family voice at all levels. Research and evidence-based programs show that adolescent treatment interventions that include families in the treatment process have a greater rate of success. A family-based approach aims to change the way family members relate to each other and encourages healthier interactions. It helps families solve problems together and to learn new strategies. It equips them with parenting skills and the community resources necessary to address inevitable difficulties. It's not an easy road, as you just heard. It bolsters the parents' self-confidence as parents, while the same time it improves the parenting skills. So we're working with a youth, and that youth's success is very much about that family's success. And a good treatment system includes that family in the process. Again, we know that adolescents are one unit of a larger system known as the family, and a system change is what I'm asking for. A system change means adolescent treatment must involve the family at the case, practice, and policy levels across the state. We need to develop a strategic plan for family and youth involvement in youth substance abuse and in mental health treatment systems. Dialogue that includes youth and their families as equal partners is essential to foster understanding and to identify shared vision and priorities. Family members that have been actively engaged in their adolescence treatment process are potentially the most effective advocates for systems change. A systems change in how we treat adolescent substance abuse and mental health. A statewide systems change that believes in its youth and families. A systems change that prioritizes youth treatment and provides the funding to recognize each youth, because it's a system that listens to the stories of youth who have faces with names like Vanessa and Shailene, and mothers like Lori and Margarita who are here today to share a very personal story that is being lived in a variety of forms every day across our state. And there's nothing more I can add to that. And so I would like to thank the committee for this opportunity to testify on behalf of all those involved with adolescent substance abuse treatment.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Sheila North, Executive Director of the Fall Treatment Centers in Portland. Thank you very much for having us today. This is a really important issue. At a recent meeting of Multnomah County Social Services Providers, The chair of the county commissioners, Ted Wheeler, made the statement that Multnomah County had, quote, the drunkest kids in the country. His comment got everyone's attention, obviously, and a lively discussion ensued about ways in which we could effectively reduce youth alcohol and drug use in our state. Oregon eighth graders use alcohol and drugs at nearly twice the national average. Oregon ranks seventh in the U.S. for illegal drug use among those aged 12 and older, and fourth in the U.S. for illicit drug dependence among 18 to 25-year-olds.
And how did we get those figures? How do they...
These are from Oregon Healthy Teens, from a national survey.
Okay.
I have footnotes in your handouts.
Thank you.
So the results of substance abuse among youth are devastating. The younger the children and adolescents are at the time they begin drinking, the more likely they will be to engage in behaviors that will harm themselves and others. At the same time, access to funded treatment in Oregon is lower than the national average, now ranking 45th in the nation on a per capita basis. Young people often turn to and abuse alcohol and other drugs to reduce the emotional pain they are experiencing. 1 in 10 American children and adolescents experience a mental disorder that is severe enough to cause impairment, and some 30% of youth experiencing mental health disorders also experience a co-occurring substance use disorder. In Oregon, this translates to more than 88,000 children and adolescents who are in need of services. Oregon drug mortality rates are twice that of the national average. The economic impact in Oregon is significant. A recently published government-sponsored survey estimates that untreated addiction costs $5.93 billion in lost wages, increased health care, criminal justice, and social services each year. These costs represent about 4% of Oregon's gross national product. Statistics also show that treatment works. The following information show Oregon outcomes for substance use disorder treatment at discharge. Reduced use, 71.8%. In other words, 72% who go through treatment show reduced use following treatment. 42% are employed at the time of discharge. Almost 50% regain custody of their children, and approximately 82% have no arrests during treatment. A drug abuse treatment outcome study is the largest addiction treatment outcome study ever performed of more than 10,000 addiction treatment clients, which spanned 5 years, demonstrated the effectiveness of treatment and found that treatment results remain steady, showing that treatment has positive long-term effects. And I think you've heard a lot about that from Senator Cruz as well as others. Treatment outcomes resulted in a 50% overall reduction in drug use and a 37% reduction in crime for outpatient participants, with a 61% reduction for residential participants. So I'm throwing a lot of numbers at you, but you have them for reference in the future. And there is definitely a connection between our adult and our adolescent consumption rates. We see multi-generational patterns of drug and alcohol use and dependency. Families create patterns of behavior, and the use of alcohol and drugs is no exception. A family systems approach creates an opportunity for healing for the entire family. Family treatment within the youth alcohol and drug treatment delivery system is provided by professionals who are uniquely equipped to address these issues. Even though some families may have received treatment in other parts of our health care and social services system, their past efforts have been unsuccessful because the substance use issue was not effectively addressed. Many family therapists, while very well trained, are often not as well trained in the field of addiction as we would hope, and they may lack the understanding to help clients navigate these troubled waters. The 2006 Oregon Research Brief on Addiction Treatment Effectiveness demonstrates that DHS child welfare estimates that 60% of child foster care placements are due to parental substance abuse. A lack of demand for services is also a problem. A family's reluctance to acknowledge a problem because of shame and fear is an often overlooked barrier to treatment. Consistent public policies and messaging, as well as increased ease of access to treatment, can help to reduce the stigma of addiction treatment and make it easier for families to seek services. Given Oregon's high numbers for consumption of drugs and alcohol and the associated cost to our public health and safety systems, a coordinated and strategic approach that brings together the various public systems that touch these youth and their families is desperately needed. The Adolescent Summit held last January brought together a national expert and many professionals from across the state. We heard a great deal about the work that other states are doing in this area, and we studied what we are doing. You have copies of that work. Oregon must have a coordinated state-level effort to pursue an adolescent treatment policy agenda. Although half of all states, most with far lower consumption rates than Oregon, have a defined public policy agenda and an adolescent treatment plan, Oregon does not. Oregon's treatment system for adolescents is fragmented and underfunded, yet it is the best opportunity there is to identify and treat the primary problem affecting these youth and their families, substance use disorders that span generations. Our state has inadequate residential treatment capacity and underutilized outpatient capacity for these families. We need a cross-agency, state-level commitment to pursue the Adolescent Summit's recommendations for improving the adolescent substance abuse treatment system over the long term.
Do we have a copy of the recommendations?
Yes, I think so.
In today?
Yeah.
Oh, it's in the report. Okay.
There are federal funds available to match any funds the state.
Got it. I just want to make sure that we have all these papers. Yeah. Okay.
There are federal funds available to match any funds the state contributes for youth alcohol and drug treatment. There are opportunities at the federal level to access funding for both prevention and treatment. The state needs a creative approach to accessing funding and potentiating state and local dollars. While we recognize that Oregon faces an unprecedented fiscal crisis, and I did wear black this morning for that reason, treatment is the best return on investment the state can achieve. Youth who enter treatment do better in school, require fewer public health and safety dollars as adults, and become productive tax-paying citizens. When we focus on youth, we must also use the opportunity to focus on their families, as we have talked about. We are able to help families become more effective and more involved with one another and to become contributors to our community. Healthy families create healthy communities. Untreated addiction destroys lives, families, and communities. While we are gratified to see that the state has done financial mapping of the treatment system, it is our understanding that it does not specifically break out adolescent funding. Oregon has an opportunity to become a leader in addressing adolescent drug and alcohol problems. There are a few things that we can do that don't cost money and could even help find money for treatment. Other states have done this and located new sources of funding for treatment. We recommend that we map all of these different sources of adolescent treatment funds, federal, state, county, and others across health, child welfare, juvenile justice, education, housing, and labor. Each of these systems referred to in my comments, public health, public safety, education, and child welfare, have funding resources for treatment. Two, that we learn the flexibility and constraints of each funding source. Three, that we identify Oregon's decisions and priorities in spending, specifically the OHP waiver. Four, we identify the administrator for each funding source. Five, we determine rates and definitions of substance abuse mental health services and analyze them for parity. We believe that investing in youth and family alcohol and drug prevention and treatment is a commitment to Oregon's future and to our national reputation as a state that uses resources effectively, preserves and protects our environment, and makes our communities great places to live. Thank you very much.
Does anyone know the answer to, the governor? We're talking about a children's initiative. And I need to know if adolescent treatment is a part of the governor's initiative and the wraparound services. It is. I see nods in the audience. Okay, that's critical. All right.
Thank you.
Any questions? All right. Thank you so very much. Sandy, do we have any others that are to speak?
Andy?
Good. You're going to speak to wrap around and...
Yes, I am, Chair.
Awesome.
Good morning, Chair Monis-Anderson and Senator Cruz. My name is Andy Smith, and today I'm here on behalf of the governor to update you on the wraparound initiative, which Senator Monis-Anderson, absolutely, the themes that we've heard this morning in the testimony are not different themes or different topics that are in any way disconnected from the wraparound initiative. So let me walk through just a few remarks, and there's some documents I will walk you through as well. But just to kind of summarize the initiative itself, the wraparound initiative is kind of in its implement. When I say kind of, we're still in the early implementation phase. And what that means is that you may recall that in December of 2007, a report was presented to the legislature that was led from the governor's office. Aaron Kelly Seal had led this effort to really do a great deal of work, conceptual work, values and principles work, system design work, to move towards a really very different system that we've heard about today, and that would be a system of care model that is, instead of being splintered, is integrated, that's holistic. And in this particular instance, the central point that connects a lot of these kids would be involvement in the mental health treatment system. But, of course, many of those children, youth, and families would also be involved in other systems, and the wraparound initiative is if they touch two systems. So if it would be being involved in the mental health system, it might be A&D, as we've discussed here today. It might be in the foster care system. It might be in the juvenile justice system. Or it just might be in school in terms of those kids needing unique services. Also to build upon, I think, what you've heard today and what is was a central point of the wraparound initiative would be that it's a consumer and family-driven model. That goes back to when Aaron in the governor's office led a group that was very much comprised of consumers and families, youth, children, and family members that were receiving services, and that will be something that we're continuing. So the phase that we're in now, we're calling it the implementation phase. What that means is we have a document that tells us what this world would look like. It's kind of what would the ideal world look like, and knowing where we want to go, before we can get there, we have to know where we want to go. And I think it truly is an exceptional document. But I think to a certain degree the bigger challenge is this phase that we have to, at least from the state's perspective, we need to, and we've begun to do it, but it's going to be not a month, 6 month challenge or a year, it'll be a period of years that we begin to change some of the things we do at the agency level to really make these systems, the system of care, work.
Is that public yet, the document describing what you're telling us right now?
The implementation phase? Well, essentially, there's no new document.
It's still based on the...
Correct, on the steering committee report of December of 2007.
Yeah. Could you email me that? Yeah.
And I'm sorry that I didn't bring that today.
That's okay.
It is quite a significant document. So, but that is the foundation for the work that we're currently doing. Let me walk you through, Chair and Senator Cruz, the one handout that has the kind of an organizational chart. So you'll see at the top there is an advisory committee that we've created over the last 2 months, and the first meeting of that group will be actually Monday. That's a quarterly group, and this is the key kind of stakeholder group that as I said, it's very much a community model and a stakeholder and a family and consumer model, but it is an advisory committee as opposed to a conceptual committee that would come up with a document. And what we really want them to do over time is to be help monitor how effective we are in implementing over time. And of course there's a state role in this, and there's also local communities need to be ready to carry out this plan, because it's not a top-down state-driven model, it is a community model. But the state certainly, in terms of financing, in terms of contracting, in terms of coordination of existing services between agencies, we have a huge role, but we're not the This is not, a top-down model by any means. So part of this process has also been that a project contractor has been on board with the state since the summer, and that their contract will run through next June. So they're doing some very crucial work that needs to be done before you can really begin to get the traction you want. One would be a statewide market assessment, because it will be comprised of a couple of different things. Of course, prevalence of these issues and needs, utilization of services, and as I said, unmet needs. So prevalence, utilization, and need. The reason that this is challenging is because the scope of that market assessment is statewide, and the contractor is working with a researcher from PSU who's designed a market assessment that isn't kind of the normal way of doing business. It will kind of combine some existing things, existing research that's been done, and then go out and systematically kind of test that data and then draw some conclusions. So rather than, because the scope of the market assessment would make that very difficult and costly to do, within the time that we have. So we'll have a market assessment that will be completed no later than the contract that will end in June of 2009. Part of that contract also includes this group will develop recommendations for us what we need to do with data, information system, information technology. Because a key piece of this is that raw data that is very, very much dispersed. And obviously we're not going to snap our fingers. This is a problem across many systems. It's not like we're going to solve it, but I think part of it is we need to continue to be more sophisticated in ways of looking at how would we design, develop, and manage a system like this. We need to kind of raise awareness in the community when we begin to build this system at some point that we need to have the buy-in of the community. This will include information, of course, about demographics, about kids and families, lots of information about providers, and, of course, tying that to existing agency programs. So it's kind of that data collection, which is fundamental across a lot of our systems, but we've employed our contractor to say, well, let's do some strategic analysis in terms of if we start to do that, how we might at least begin to build or have the pillars in place so we know what that system should look like.
Who's the contractor?
For the contract itself? It is actually a consortium. It's a group of folks in Multnomah County, wraparound Oregon, a number of folks that have been involved in the metro area. Because there is a wraparound, it's a little bit confusing, Senator. There is a wraparound Oregon that exists that's in the metro region, and then they've been building capacity and doing lots of very significant things for six, seven, 8 years. So we're bringing kind of that local expertise in a team model. So it's actually a team. It's not a single individual or a private contractor. It's many of those folks that have been involved in that effort. So as I said, this just jumping back to the diagram a bit, the advisory committee is just that. It is advisory. It's not a quorum body, not a voting body, but really kind of to keep from the consumer and public and provider and all of the folks that want this to succeed, to keep kind of the pressure on the state to say, okay, you've done the conceptual groundwork support, but over time this is not a short-term investment. And they will help us kind of, I think part of the design is to help us be accountable in terms of the state's commitment to do this. So another key piece of this is that when the contractor's work does end and they have some discrete pieces of their work, that the agencies, which are really key components, as I talked about, in terms of huge issues like financing, and will this be kind of pooled funding? Will all of our separate streams at some point, because some states do that, they kind of pool their funding and then in turn try to build a system around that. Some start with braiding funding, and in other words, you have separate funding streams, but they're coordinated and aligned. So there are different ways you can do that, but clearly we need to do that in a way that we haven't done before. That's a fundamental. So financing is one, and there are a number of other issues that our agencies need to lead on, but they're huge issues at the kind of middle levels of these agencies that this needs to happen. So we're also trying to build capacity within, and it's a number of agencies. It's DHS, of course. It's OIA. It's at the Commission on Children and Families. It's the Department of Education. Key partners that need to work together to do some of these things, because there are resources in these systems, but I mean one of the key problems is they haven't ever been aligned. I mean they've been sometimes they're duplicative, sometimes there are gaps in the systems, but there's a lot of work there to do that isn't new resource. I mean that's a huge piece of this, and in fact the goal would be that the service doesn't just get better, that's the ultimate goal for the children and families involved, but that we use our resources better. So the model actually allows you to do both. So wrapping up kind of quickly, when the contractor goes away in June, we're not waiting for the agency, because the agency is working with them, but rather than kind of say, okay, we've done our work and pass it to the agency, we're trying to start building that capacity now over the next 8 months. And we've just started to meet, and we're gonna pull Karen in, Karen Wheeler from AMH, but she would be a key representative. We have other folks from DHS, but we've just started to meet directly with the contractor to say, okay, we don't want to drop that handoff. When you do your work, we don't want essentially a briefing and the contractor's gone. We want the agency to be working right alongside the contractor, and then when they leave, they can continue to do the work. So the only other thing that I'd leave here, and I'd be happy to answer questions, would be a list of the advisory committee members.
Yes, I'd like to know who the makeup of that is, yeah.
So that you should have that.
Oh, yeah, I mean, this is it.
You'll see it is a large group, but it's Ooh. Large because it represents, there are many partners in this, and in terms of a system of care model, we really need to be consulting and partnering and having the feedback from many different pieces of this system. So you'll see there are many educators. You'll also see OFSN is Oregon Family Support Network, which is family support for families that are currently involved or have received treatment. So those OFSN individuals are both family members and youth that are consumers. So you'll see that it is a large consumer. That's, as I said, a central piece of this model. We have a number of other folks as well, from whether it's providers or judges to district attorney. We have a district attorney and a representative from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And some of these folks were involved in the steering committee phase of the initiative, and some were not. But to a certain degree, this is a new group of people, so we're also helping build awareness around the initiative. And I think some of the early decisions will be about what are the communities that are most ready to kind of begin to pilot new places where we can, because it is a local model, we'll look at communities where we can start to ramp up at some point.
Is there specific legislation that is going to be needed at all regarding this other than funding?
Sure, there is. There is an LC that has been drafted and is not quite finalized from the governor that would, it doesn't, It in many ways, it puts into statute many of the ideal ambitions. It's not new money. In other words, these aren't mandates to agencies because we felt we couldn't do that in this environment.
Yeah.
But they would be having to do with cultural competency, which is another key component that I don't know if I've fairly or even discussed.
Yeah.
It's a key component of this. All interagency cooperation, and it spells it out in quite detail. That is still being refined. We got it back from LC, I think, last week. But that will be something that the governor will be attempting to move forward in this session. Would be kind of a long-term anchor over time, that if there's a new administration, which there will be, that this would still be a
preamble.
Yes, ma'am.
I think that's critical. I was, we hear these reports and then we don't do anything about them, and that's why I was sort of hoping that maybe there was some LC in the works.
There is, and it's not quite ready for release, but as I said, it came back last week, and then there's this very limited time when we can tweak it, and the governor's office is tweaking it, but that LC will be moving forward.
Excellent. Yes.
I'd be interested in knowing where the OFSN reps are from. I'm assuming it's kind of statewide. The purpose of that would be if there are some in my part of the world that we can have contact with. The only other thing, Madam Chair, and I understand this, it's kind of a frustration for me. I mean, this is a statewide children's wraparound initiative. I wish it was called the statewide family wraparound initiative. And I understand the marketing aspect
marketing
of this. But clearly you can't do anything for kids that's going to work unless the family's included in it. And we have examples here today. So, it's kind of like you can't pick a pebble up off of a dirt floor and clean it up and throw it back there on the dirt floor and think you've done anything. Unless we're dealing with the family, we are kind of not being as broad as we should be in this. And I understand that that's included here. I just wish on the front end the focus was slightly different from the marketing perspective.
Fair point. We can't. We couldn't turn that part of the clock back in terms of how we describe things in the future. I will.
Mm-hmm.
That's very good advice in terms of how it's perceived.
Great. Thank you so much. This, I think, has been great information, and I think will give us a stepping stone into addressing what we will be dealing with in the 09 session.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
You,
with that, I'll close. Are we done with?
Yes.
Yeah. So thank you very much, Vanessa and Shalene. So thank you very much for being here. And if we can, if we need you in the future, we may be contacting you again to come on down to speak to some other people. Okay? All right. Thank you very much. With that, I'll close the informational hearing on the Adolescent Substance Abuse Treatment Summit report. And I'd like to open...
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to open the information... informational meeting on the scope of practice process advisory group recommendations. And Sam Imperati and Laurel Singer, if you would come forward. Okay.
Barney is here.
No, they have to leave early. And Barney said that he didn't hear.
Okay.
Hi, Laurel.
Hi, Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Cruz.
How you doing?
Thank you. Sam is sorry that he could not be here today.
That's fine.
And I appreciate you moving us up in the agenda because of some of the constraints I had on time. And especially appreciate your time and attention given the very compelling issues that you have to deal with today, especially the powerful speakers that we just heard. I know this is... not quite the impact that you just heard, and it affects something that affects Oregonians a little more subtly. And that has to do with the ways that scope of practice decisions get made in the legislature. And again, I'm Laurel Singer, and I'm with Oregon Consensus Program. We convened the human...
Just as a preface to remind Senator Cruz, I think you remembered Senate Bill 717, which was the scope of practice, and the lobby really had issues with that. And so...
They were wrong.
They were wrong. But so this group basically has been meeting over the interim where it's strictly lobby. Coming up with what they can see. So with that, go ahead.
Right. So we called ourselves the Human Health-Related Scope of Practice Process Advisory Group, which rolls right off the tongue, and we shortened it to PAG. And this was a very broad group of stakeholders. It was voluntary. It was self-selected. It was open for whoever really wanted to participate. We had 31 members and I think 50 or so interested parties who were kept apprised of the work of the PAG. We met four half sessions. And really the purpose of the PAG was to develop recommendations to give to you about a process for responding for legislative scope of human health care requests. So as you know right now, there currently is not a process defined. They can be very intractable, long-standing issues over what a profession can or can't do when you get this request. So one of the things I want to give a disclaimer about this report, we wanted to be able to apprise you on the work of the PAG to date. This is not a final report. Our collaboration agreements of the group require that we send it for everybody who wasn't at our final meeting, that they get an opportunity to weigh in on these recommendations before they're finalized. We've not had a chance to do that. So they reflect the quorum that was at our last meeting and the consensus of the group. But we will be polling all the rest of our members to get their agreement, and that could change the ultimate results. So I'm going to present to you what is the status of the current work of the group. They did come to a consensus on a number of issues, and I'm going to, instead of walking you through, I'm just going to highlight some of the key decisions that were made. The first, if you jump over to, page 4, the bottom of the page is recommendation number 13, and this was achieved by consensus and majority, is that basically the group agreed that all scope of practices should be required to respond to a template of criteria in order to make those decisions. And number 16 goes through a lot of those criteria. This is historical context, education and training, the evidence that exists, the regulatory environment, and some additional factors. And there was primarily consensus over most of the criteria, and you'll see where it's noted where there was a majority and some of the numbers, how that panned out. The other thing is that there was also a recommendation that there be an impartial forum not composed of legislative members, other non-legislative, and that would be number, I think that's 13. Let's see, that would be on page 4 again, and this is number 10, that the impartial forum would provide a report to the legislative committees that would basically summarize the information that the parties had responded to on the criteria, summarize the studies and the evidence, summarize the information presented by each side, the areas of agreement and the areas of disagreement, and that the forum would convene one, at least one meeting where all parties could be gathered together to discuss the template and the way they responded to it. So then the forum would present that. It was also...
There are a number of different ideas there, and can you remind me exactly, some of the ideas was having someone who's staffing this, so that, could you just comment on that?
Yes, I think the idea was that there would be an impartial person that would have a staff person who would be available to take notes and create a report that would go to the Legislative Commission. The committee grappled with what really should be the role of the impartial forum. And there were a lot of ideas that were discussed. And at issue was whether it should be a recommending body, a fact analysis body, or simply a reporting body. And the idea was that the impartial forum would support the legislative process. It was consensus that the decisions about scope of practice should remain in the legislature. That was strong consensus. But the role of what that impartial forum should be was not necessarily clear at this point. There was some agreement that it should be meaningful, but what it should look like. So at this point, the consensus was it would simply be a reporting body that would summarize the issues, and that instead of it being a panel, as one of the ideas that was thrown out, is it would just be a possibly an entity or person or facilitator who would simply be a process person to facilitate that dialogue and that reporting process, and then submit that back. Mm-hmm. So it's a placeholder. The other recommendation is that those cases that would go through that neutral forum would be selected by Senator Monty Anderson or Mitch Greenlick, and that there'd be a couple of those that might come through the legislative process this year. All of these recommendations are simply recommended to be piloted in the next legislative session, and that nothing be committed to any long-term legislation until it's been piloted and evaluated. And there was a strong recommendation that there be an evaluation process at the end of it that includes both those people who went through it, the PAG members. I think that's listed on it's number 13. And that they would present their findings 6 months after the pilot was completed. And there's some criteria about what they'd want to be looking at, and that's listed under recommendation number 13. So those are the main recommendations at this point.
And I wanted to bring to committee staff attention to, because funding is such a huge issue, and there are some of us that are very committed into having just a more organized fashion in treating scopes within the legislature, and we still need to look at funding, because there needs to be funding for whoever's going to facilitate it, and there was an idea of even committee staff being able to screen this too, to start out with.
So, Madam Chair, when you say committee staff, you mean make it
A director for committee services within that office. Is that accurate? Okay, thank you.
So there's a lot of elements of implementation, and Oregon Consensus would be willing to work with you after this process to look at those details. And I know there's a few of our committee members here. I don't know if they want to add anything or not, but there's a full list of the committee members on the last page of the report.
Well, this is the first draft. I'm so glad that Senator Cruz is here to hear it. He was, I think this is our first implementation of ideas, and I don't know if you have any comments.
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, I'm trying to find a better way. I mean, we've been through the scope battles many times. I guess I'm interested in the concept of somebody who's neutral or impartial that still has the base knowledge necessary to weigh in. You know, nobody's ever neutral.
Right. That came up for sure. And I think the idea, and again, the role of what that impartial forum might look like is still something that the committee would continue to discuss. At this point, because of the complexities that you're getting at, the recommendation is that it not be a fact analysis or a body that weighs in, but simply takes the information and presents it back to the committee on a couple cases to see how that works as a beginning point because of, I think, the issues that you're talking about.
Yeah, and from my perspective, Madam Chair, what we're really after is and I agree that the final decision rests with us, as it should, but just to have as fair and unbiased as a data set to make a decision with. That's what we want. We want to have all the facts on the table, and so that we have some certainty in a decision we make, because we have had times when we haven't quite had that.
No, we go with our gut or who our friend is.
Right. Yeah. And so I think what this committee is recommending is at least some criteria you can use as you weigh in on the information you're presenting.
And just to let you know, Senator Cruz, on this process to me was very fair. And the Oregon Consensus staff that staffed this, Laurel and Sam Imperati, and who's the?
Christina.
And Christina. We're able to just gather information and just organize it in a fashion that I felt was very impartial in getting input from the lobbyists. And it would be nice if the lobby out there, since so many of you are out there, have any words of support or opposition. If you don't want to come up now, you can definitely put it in writing to let us know what your reactions were to this process, because there was some of you that were just had your heels dug in and don't want anything to change because you like what it is. But I think that comes primarily from the more powerful lobbies. So here we have Tresidor, who wasn't even a member of the committee. He would just
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, Alan Tresidor. I represent the Oregon Dental Association and participated in the Scope of Practice Advisory Group. I wasn't a voting member. I didn't want to be a voting member. I wanted to be able to sit on the outside and comment when appropriate and not have to vote. And that worked pretty well.
You'll be a lousy legislator then.
I also do not want to be a legislator. Let's make the record abundantly clear on that. I think this process was healthy for all of us. We all understand how scope of practice issues.
Now, when you say we all, you're speaking
the lobby.
For the lobby.
So, yeah. I'll take the liberty of speaking for my colleagues, and they can hit me if I say something I shouldn't say. We understand very clearly that scope of practice issues are difficult for legislators. It's difficult for us, and it's even more so for you because it's almost always a lot of good data on both sides to prove the points, and you have to flip a coin almost to see how that goes. I don't think there's any need for scope of practice issues that, you know, they affect public safety. that is always our key concern, that make sure that patients and clients are safe, and that's where the discussion starts. So something like this, we spent, I don't know how many meetings we had, but we had
four
meetings.
Exciting meetings.
It seemed like more, quite frankly. They were very long, 4 or 5 hour meetings. Sam did a good job of leading us through this discussion. I think there's still a lack of consensus among those of us who represent various professional license groups of whether this process will work, but I think I would be remiss if I said I support everything that's in this report, because I don't. But I think piloting this effort is a good idea, that we can all learn by that. There's probably a better way of doing scope of practice issues than us having a knife fight in front of your committee every session. That just doesn't, if you win, it was a good process. If you lose, the process is not very good. And I don't know if this is the answer, but we are all willing to work with you and your committees in the pilot process to help you make better decisions. The bottom line is we want you to make better decisions. We all believe that if you have all the information that's available, then you'll make good decisions.
Sometimes.
If you win, it was a good decision. If you're on the losing side, it was a terrible decision. But I think I would always argue that this process works, doesn't work for everybody every time, but it works. And that if you do have all the information in front of you, generally speaking, you all make the right decisions, and we're willing to go with that.
The problem, though, that's come before us is it's not very organized at all. I like the template piece where we have both the opposition and the proponents having a sort of a set standard criteria to report to us. And I also like the idea of having staffing to coordinate that, so that we aren't having all this information coming from different people. It's just.
And Madam Chair, as I said to you during these process, as chair of a committee, you can request anything of us. If you want us to fill out a 5-page questionnaire, we'll fill it out. If you want us to have we are at your beck and call, and whatever rules you and your committee set up are the rules we play by. And so whatever you want us to do, that's what we'll do. And we'll encourage, as long as the other side has to do the same thing, then I don't care what the rules are. As long as they're fair and everybody plays by the same rules, then my clients and I don't care what those rules say.
Well, yeah, Alan, we're no worse off than we have been at this point. The proof will be in the pudding when we get down to it. And I think ultimately I'm not saying that we have made bad decisions on scope of practice, but oftentimes it has taken far longer than it should have.
I'm very emotional also.
To get there. I mean, what we have had some battles that have gone on for 3 or 4 sessions before
we get to resolution. I came to work in this building in 1977, and there was a discussion at that time. In 1977, we had a discussion about optometrists prescribing drops for the eyes. Okay, that was 32 years ago, and that discussion is ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. Some of these things do not resolve themselves easily, or they're never really over.
And from my perspective, Madam Chair, public safety clearly is of major importance, but access to care is.
I was just
going to
say
it,
yes,
so.
It's access, and it's ever expanding, and so. We are looking at access, but then we have to look at utilization, and then we have to look at cost, and then we have to, so there's a whole lot more. But the safety, I think, and the consumer should be the absolute primary
reason. I think it is by far your prime concern is patient safety. That we can argue whether people have access to certain kinds of care, but just because you live in rural Oregon or you live in Oregon that is not readily accessible to health care doesn't mean you should be entitled to substandard health care. Okay?
Agreed.
And so I think we have to balance access and safe patient care very carefully.
Is there any other lobby that wants to say a couple of words?
And I would just add, I would compliment the committee members. As Alan mentioned, this was a very demanding process. There was lots of material, lots of action in between meetings, and I really was impressed with the level of commitment to this process. Now, ultimately, everyone acknowledges it's a complicated system, and the goal at this point is to begin to tweak it and see how that works, and just as an opening step. So.
And I do want to thank all of the lobby, I mean, truly, for being there. And for some, it seems like you were just enduring it. But I am very committed into making a system that is that will work well for the legislators and the lobby. Okay. Thank you, Laurel, so very much.
Community service. Yes.
Okay. All right, let's just break for about 5 minutes, and then the next group on board is the update on nursing shortage from the Oregon Center of Nursing. Are they here? We will find them. We will recess right now. We're having it's November 20th, and we're having some informational reports, and we're now going to have an update on the nursing shortage from the Oregon Center of Nursing. I'm so glad that you're here. And just a preface for Senator Cruz's sake, I have a real interest on healthcare workforce shortage issues statewide in all professions. And back in 2000, when I was first elected, and in the 2001 session, we had Senate Bill 800, and we were working, and that was really my first step into this healthcare workforce shortage issue. And the nurses just took it by storm, and they have done so much for the state of Oregon and in nursing care. And I actually want to have more knowledge now on what the individual nursing programs in the state, how they have increased their production of nurses between now from 2000 to 2008. And then I want this also be done for physicians like OHSU really want to know how they are how many doctors they're putting out, and the residents, how many out of state they have versus in state. I think that is critical, because we like to sort of educate our own, and rumors are telling me that that's not happening in the state in that profession. I know it's just using the back, so that's why I'm saying this, so that they'll know what to come forward with in January. The same with the physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and nurse anesthetists, dental association, the CNAs. Of course, CNAs may come under you, do they? Yeah, so we'll know that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I've also been concerned about this issue for a long time as well, and one of the things I'm trying to get information on right now, I've asked some community college presidents to give me some data and in an attempt potentially to do some targeted funding at the community college level, because quite honestly, if we just throw more money into the system, it goes into the formula. And we know, for example, that we're having trouble attracting nurses away from private sector into teaching. And so what I'm trying to do is come up with a way that we can do some targeted funding that wouldn't go into the salary formula, so that we can ramp up on in that specific area. And it'd have to be, you know, I mean, if it's targeted funding, we got to be able to deliver results and all that. But I think it's a concept that we should probably try to explore and move forward with. I think it's and what I'm getting from community colleges at this point in time is some of them like the concept and some of them don't. So
some of that issue too. Great. Well, with that introduction, take it away.
Good morning, Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Cruz. I'm Chris Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Nursing, and I am so pleased to be here to be able to talk about
those things that you just spoke about, which are very near and dear to our hearts. I will give an overview of the nursing shortage in the States, and then my colleagues, Dr. Warner and Dr. Gubrud Howe, will tell you about their experiences attracting faculty and expanding nursing program expansion from their universities. So, as you know, the Oregon Center for Nursing was created in 2002 to address the nursing shortage. It was created by the nursing leaders in the state. And we had a strategic plan to solve the nursing shortage, and we've done a tremendous amount of work, as Senator Mona Sanderson has pointed out, in this state. We have more than doubled enrollment in our nursing programs statewide since 2000. And we are graduating 80% more nurses than we were at that time, which is a phenomenal effort, and no other state has quite those numbers. Some have done it by region, some have done it by school, but nobody has done that statewide like Oregon has done that. And that's because
and just to let you know, I was at a conference, a regional reforming states group at the Milbank Foundation that focuses on health care, and I was giving them those statistics, and they wanted to know how we did it. And so I said, well, it's too bad we didn't meet, but there is information. So we may be calling on you to give specifics to some other groups on how we in Oregon were able to do that.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson. And we are working with other states, actually, in that capacity as well. So we would be happy to do that. And in order to promote or to support all of that program expansion, we've done a lot of other work. We've developed a clinical placement site that uses fewer resources for faculty and has increased the and has helped industry as well for the clinical placement of all those extra nursing students that we now actually have 11 other states are using as well. And has increased.
What did you call it?
Student Max. It's a regional clinical placement program, which is a success story for collaboration and innovation, I think. Mm. And we've also, as you're familiar with the Simulation Alliance, not necessarily a nursing initiative, but all the initial work was done by nursing. Certainly can be used for all the other health professions as well. And the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education, which I think you're familiar with, but I'll let Dr. Gubrud Howe talk about that, how we're increasing the BSN pipeline, because our real challenge now, what we really need to work on, is our faculty shortage. We have, as I said, more than doubled the number of students in our nursing programs statewide. Community colleges, the private schools, OHSU and their campuses, everyone has worked together to do that. But we haven't increased our faculty at the same rate. We have only a 10% increase in the number of faculty for all of those extra students. That is not sustainable even for the short term. Mm-hmm. So our challenge now really is to build our faculty workforce. And at the same time, our faculty are retiring. The average faculty nurse is a little bit older than the average nurses, and we're all 50 and older. Over half of the nurses in Oregon are over 50. So our challenge is huge. We have a crisis that we're facing, and we have really pulled together in this state to address the faculty shortage issue. We are part of a national capacity building coalition, nursing capacity building. Oregon is one of 18 states that is involved in an effort to increase capacity in Oregon. Our team, which is educators from all the different kinds of schools that we have, the governor's office is working with us as well, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, the community colleges and workforce development, we have employers and consumers and philanthropy. We are all building this strategic plan to solve the nursing shortage in this state. Our very first action is to get loan repayment, and we're going to need the legislature's help to do this so that we can get people into faculty positions. So we also need to address salaries. That is the number one barrier to recruiting new faculty. OCN, we will have it published shortly, a faculty shortage survey, or a faculty survey. Only 30% of the faculty are anywhere near satisfied with their salaries, and it's a huge deterrent to getting new faculty. So if we can at least help pay their loans for them to serve as faculty, then they don't have the double whammy of paying for graduate education and then making less money than they were making before they went to graduate school. I talked with a young woman yesterday, actually it was 2 days ago, who is in a master's program, really, really wants to teach. She is a, and she works with students now. She's an assistant nurse manager at Providence Portland. She is making almost $90,000 a year, and she thought she would go, she would like to teach because she loves that role, and she was offered, I have it right here, $44,465 for a starting salary. She said she could not afford to do it. Mm-hmm. She will have $22,000 in loans. She said that would really make a difference in offsetting the salary, though the salaries need to be addressed. We are looking at how we might increase salaries, and I loved that you have that as one of the things you would like to do, Senator Cruz. We think that that might be done with some public-private partnerships as well, and so we're looking. We don't know how we're going to do that yet, but we will come up with a plan to do that. Our other big issue that we must address is faculty workload. Those full-time faculty, those 10%, the faculty that are in full-time positions and the few extra that we have for those double the number of students are working incredibly hard. Our service partners, so the nurses and in our clinical agencies and the hospitals, public health, long-term care, have done a remarkable effort in helping us educate our nurses. But that still creates more burden for the full-time faculty to coordinate all of that. So somehow we have to work on addressing workload issues, which may make the faculty numbers even more of a challenge, but we will never be able to even retain the people that we have right now. If we recruit new folks in and they work a whole lot harder, then, and I think you have a great story about losing a faculty because they had no idea how much work that was. So. Mm-hmm. So that is what we're working on in this state, and we certainly would appreciate help with that. And with that, I'm happy to answer questions now, or you can hear this from Dr.
Let's
Werner.
Let's hear all, and then I know I have questions, but okay. You might be answering them.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chris. And thank you, Chair Miles Anderson and Senator Cruz. My name is Joanne Warner, and I serve as the Dean of Nursing at the University of Portland. And I thank you for the opportunity to explain the realities and the implications of the nursing faculty workforce from the private perspective, from the private college perspective. We are a independently owned Catholic institution on the bluff. Nursing is, and besides women's soccer, nursing is the largest major on campus. We have about 650 undergraduate students and around 80 graduate students. We have extended our resources and our capability to triple our enrollment in the last while, since about 2003. We've done that in a variety of ways. We have moved to admission twice a year. We have moved to year-round school. And probably the largest innovation was to implement a clinical teaching model called a dedicated education unit. By doing that, we partnered with Providence Portland, Providence St. Vincent's, and the Portland VA to create special units where the clinical staff, as Dr. Campbell was describing, the clinical staff serve one-on-one with our students or one-to-two as the clinical expert currently grounded in what is going on. We provide the faculty oversight and leadership, and the students get the best of everything. Learning from a clinical expert at the bedside, having a theoretical grounding and support from the university. It's a marvelous partnership that has allowed us, that's really extended our faculty resource. We have also, as was mentioned, worked hard with our simulation suite. And we, several years ago, began a pretty robust faculty development program to assist our faculty to go back and get their doctoral degrees. But that hasn't solved it for us, because what we're doing is really unsustainable in terms of the effort, the overload that faculty are teaching, and the ongoing stress of finding faculty. Here we are mid-November, and I have classes, labs, and clinicals uncovered yet for January. And it is a constant constant effort for me. This is what keeps me up at night. And if I get any inquiry, I jump right on it and I respond and I say we're always looking for talented faculty, and follow every lead that we have. The risk when we move to additional adjunct and additional part-time is that there are fewer faculty to provide the continuity, the congruence, the good thinking in the curriculum, developing the curriculum, implementing it, and maintaining, evaluating it, maintaining that continuity. So it's not, even if we could find, well-prepared, committed, excellent people to serve as adjunct, you can't continue to build an excellent program by teaching with more and more part-time, more and more adjunct faculty. The other issue that was mentioned was salary, and I would just say from the perspective of a private university, it is yet more significant for us. I have a table in my written testimony that shows that our salaries from a national database are yet lower. We're doing some work gathering data here in Oregon, and we'll have that pulled together at some point.
Is that statewide? For all professors, are our professors statewide paid lower? Do you know?
One of our team members on the Oregon team is a recent dean, a new dean to this area, and she has looked at national salaries. She said she took a 20% pay cut to come to Oregon, and the cost of living is 40% higher than it was in Indiana, where she was before.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. But Oregon's a better state.
I know. I'd much rather live here than Indiana.
Well, we wouldn't dispute you there. And all of these challenges come within a discipline whose information, whose scientific evidence base doubles every 18 months. And so it is an amazing effort for us to keep current and to maintain the reputation that Oregon has of the excellent nursing programs in the state. I know my stories are mirrored by my colleagues in the other private schools, and I thank you for listening to us and sharing the belief that this is critical to Oregon's future and health and security. And that we hope that you will partner with us to be a part of the solution.
Thank you.
I'm Paula Gubrud Howe, and I am currently the simulation director for the OHSU School of Nursing, so I have responsibility for the five OHSU campuses. I am also a project director for the Oregon Consortium Nursing Education Clinical Redesign Issue. So I have responsibility for leading the charge to redesign clinical education for our 8 community college programs and 5 OHSU campuses. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education. I think you're both pretty familiar with it. It's a collaboration between 8 community colleges and the 5 OHSU campuses. We have a shared competency-based curriculum, same courses for the first 2 years. Students then have the opportunity to go on and get their bachelor's degree in their communities when they begin the program at a participating community college. And they can also take their licensing exam and become RNs after finishing their associate degree. So we see this as real potential for the pipeline needed to prepare more nursing faculty with expeditious opportunity to earn a bachelor's degree in nursing at all corners of our state. We've also created state-of-the-art simulation labs that every consortium school either has access to or has embedded in their own campus and have shared faculty development and the infrastructure needed to get simulation up and running. We've shared purchasing power to equip our laboratories and hire consultants for needed faculty development. And recently, because of the faculty shortage, we have also begun sharing faculty. One story is Umpqua Community College could not find a faculty to teach pathophysiology last spring and was able to contract with or work with Southern Oregon University OHSU campus. And they provided a faculty that commuted once a week from Ashland to Umpqua to teach a class. And we have many exemplars of those kinds of arrangements emerging because of the faculty shortage. So we have done incredible work through all of our efforts, the private schools, the community colleges, OHSU. As mentioned, we have more than doubled enrollment, and we just learned that with all that work, we have also maintained a world-class nursing education system. We currently have the highest pass rate on the RN NCLEX in the nation.
Really?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Right, number one. Right. So we're very proud of the work that we've done together, and thank both of you for your support, as I know personally that it's been ongoing since we started this endeavor. However, we do have a significant problem with retention and recruitment of nursing faculty. I'll start with one story about retention. This is particularly an issue for our small rural community colleges where they have maybe 4-6 faculty and supplement heavily with part-time. Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay recruited a baccalaureate prepared nurse who wanted to become a master's prepared nurse educator. The rest of the faculty supported her through an online program. When she finished, she was a stellar educator, but incurred significant loans, and a local hospital offered her a salary for almost twice as much as her community college faculty salary, and so she left. And unfortunately, that's becoming a more and more common story. So we have a retention problem, and that's related to salaries and workloads. In the community college system, we're using workload formulas that were created in the 70s, and they no longer reflect the actual workload of the rigors of clinical education and all the things that nursing faculty have to do. We also have a recruitment problem. Chris just told you a story of an up-and-coming nurse educator who is getting the credentials to be fully qualified, but we can't compete with halving her salary, getting half as much salary as her practice, and then incurring significant loans. So we have begun to develop solutions, and we have some ideas. One is a loan repayment program, which we're specifically asking your assistance with. What we imagine is a system where faculty, when they finish getting their master's or doctoral degrees, allowing them to teach, they will get accrued loan repayment. So after first year, so much will be repaid. Second year, so much. So basically, they can work off their loans. We need your continued support to increase enrollment in our graduate programs. We do have a significant shortage of faculty coming in 2 short years. According to our predictions, we will have. Well, I'll let Chris talk about it, but it's overwhelming. And we also. Ask for your support as we begin to address the salary and the workload issues.
Madam Chair, I'm not opposed to the loan repayment, but that's short term, because once they've fulfilled that obligation, they may go on to greener pastures at that point in time. I it does come back, and my sister-in-law was actually part of the consortium for curriculum development, and now she's moved on. So, and really that is one of the major issues for her was I can do a lot more hours for a lot less pay. And so it is a critical issue. And, you know, where the funds come from, I mean, it's probably going to have to be a mix. It's, you know, the state ain't going to have the resources to do the whole thing itself, but it still comes back to our ability to segregate the dollars from general dollars going to institutions, and that's going to be a tough nut to crack. Mm-hmm. So,
well, Chairman Sanderson and Senator Cruz have taken on tough nuts before.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying it's not insolvable, but it's a slightly different paradigm than what we've been doing before. So we're going to need to be very deliberative in the way we go about it.
Mm-hmm. And we're happy to help in any way. We know, as Dr. Grubert said, that we are going to lose about a quarter of our faculty just in the next couple of years. And that's, we are already recruiting for about 50 positions because of present vacancies and planned growth in some of the programs already that have been working on their planned growth already. We're going to lose 50% of our faculty by 2025, 50% mm-hmm. of them. So we have an urgent need. And our intention with the loan repayment, our vision of that is over 5 years, and by then we hope we can have worked on some of the retention issues and then can keep those faculty that we have. So if we do 20% a year for up to 5 years, we've got a chance to acculturate them to our fabulous institutions.
Okay, I have, in order to... Well, it seems like we are solving, in a sense, our nursing shortage. I mean, we haven't solved it, but I mean that we've doubled it. Okay. And so now the real focus is on nursing faculty. But what I really need from you for next January is nursing school by nursing school, what their enrollment was in 2000, what it is now, and two or three things like... Dr. Warner said regarding what they did, like the what did you call it, Student Max and the Simulation Alliance, etc. Those successes have to be shared with the rest of the legislators because we're going to have all the other professions reporting too what their enrollment was in 2000 and then what it is now in 2008 and why it is the way it is, because everyone says we have shortages, we can't fill our positions. I also need to know what the turnover rate is in the institutions. That wouldn't be necessarily from you, but from the hospitals.
Yeah, we have that.
Yeah, do you have that?
We are... Chairman Sanderson, we have we are writing up our updated workforce report. So
excellent.
We have the faculty data.
Excellent.
We did the faculty survey that will be done by the beginning of July.
January.
I'm hoping
it starts with a J.
January, and we also have supply and demand information about
that's the type of information that I definitely want from nurses, but then from all of the health professions. And mm-hmm. Sandy's going to be notifying the other professional groups, saying that we really, really want to know the status, because everyone says we're so short on GPs, we're going to a medical home model, and we need more nurse practitioners, we need more PAs, we need more GPs. So if this is really the way we're going, I want to know what the capacity is in the healthcare professional training areas here. And I also would like to know those that aren't a part of the consortium, how do they fare? Are they increasing their enrollment mm-hmm. Just as the others too? I think that's all that information from those that aren't a part of the consortium too.
They are.
So, yeah, that's great. Any other things that you would like to know?
No. This is critical. I mean, but allied health is just as critical. So, if we're going to a medical home model.
I don't know.
Conceptually, I like it.
Yeah.
conceptually, I do too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's a few details yet to be worked out.
Okay. All right. All right. Chairman Sanderson.
Thank you so very much. And now, do you have legislative concepts put forward yet?
There's a there. Policy option package to the governor.
To the governor. Okay. All right. Okay.
No, that's all right. I just want to make sure that
it's
in the works, because though what we find is that we really need to have we're going to be on a fast track just like we were last time, and I do like the deadlines, but we need things being introduced now so that they're going to be ready to go, because we're going to have all of our hearings by a certain time, and I just want to make sure our nursing issues get through.
Okay.
Thank you so very much.
All right. Thank you very much. All right, moving right along, we're going to have a report on the draft health plan from the Oregon Health Fund Board. Bonnie Spate.
I thought he retired.
This is my last official act.
Is it okay?
We'll make the most of it.
Is that why you had the big Yahoo?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That's it.
So where do you go next, Barney?
I'm going to take a little time off, Senator.
Okay.
But I am retiring from health policy. So this will be perhaps the, as I've said to some, this will be the last time I sit behind a legislative microphone unless subpoenaed.
Well, we've thought that before.
Well,
once or twice, Mark.
Hey, for the record, introduce yourself.
You've been wrong in the past.
We haven't started. We're just talking.
Okay,
now.
We're just talking now. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barney Spate. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Fund Board, and what I'm going to do today, with your indulgence, is give you a little background of where we've been, where we are, and selling at a very high level the components of the now final plan. As you know, the board was chartered by Senate Bill 329, and the first organizational meeting of the board was October 2nd of last year. So when we deliver the report to the governor and legislative leadership, which is scheduled for next Tuesday, the 25th, we will have been at this 420 days. The board did its work through seven committees and two work groups. There were about almost 150 volunteers that were on those committees. And, of course, the board is a seven-person board. Over 108 meetings of the committees and the board. And in addition, when we released the draft report on September 3rd, we visited 10 communities to get public responses to the report, including Gresham. We didn't make it to Roseburg, but we were in Keene and Hillsboro. Let me give Portland, Hillsboro, Bend, Medford, Gresham, Eugene, Salem, LeGrand, Corvallis, and Newport. And throughout those 10 hearings, we had over 1,000 attendees.
Yeah,
and
huge.
We also received over 1,500 comments, either in writing. On the 30th of September, we had a half-day public testimony in a formal sense, email, and other commentary. So it's been a one of the things, and I'm pleased that several people have complimented the board on kind of the transparency and openness of this whole process. And I'm proud of that. I'm also proud of the diversity that we had on all of the committees as far as perspectives, different perspectives and points of view. As I said, the board met on Monday, this last Monday, on the 17th, and finalized and adopted the report in final form, and staff now is making the last tweaks. We'll deliver it, as I said, next week. And clearly, for those who are either in attendance at the meeting, for those who are not, we will have those reports available that day. In essence, the charter of the board by 329 was basically one thing: to develop a comprehensive plan. So the work of the board is concluded. And the report hopefully will be of value to the 2009 legislature as a framework for discussing health care reform in Oregon, particularly at a very difficult time. One of the points that I have made over the months, and yesterday was a kind of a historic day when we get the revenue forecast, is that we started this journey in a completely different world than we're in today. I think the Dow was over 12,000, and the housing, national housing issues in August and September of a year ago were just emerging in the minds of many.
Were already existed. Just a second, Barney. Will the final version that you present be significantly different than what's available online at currently?
Not particularly. No.
Okay.
No. In fact, the major changes that we made from September 3rd were comments that people had is that because it's a comprehensive plan, it's very broad-ranged, and I'll get into some of the high-level over, but some people wanted to see it arranged in a way that was easier to, for example, look at what are the recommendations that are focusing on cost containment. And so we've put some new sections in the report of just taking some things and consolidating them so you can read them in a kind of strategic sense. But the underlying, there were no what I would call substantive changes in the recommendations that were released from September 3rd. There was more of an organizational. We had people ask for, can you put clear timelines on this? So we've got some timeline tables. One of the major recommendations is the development of a health authority. And so we have a few-page introduction of why the board feels that a new entity that would replace both the board and the Health Policy Commission is necessary to help drive health policy or health reform in the subsequent years. With that, though, the framework of the report is the same. We've used a building block metaphor, seven essential building blocks. The first one looking at expansion of coverage. And, of course, this is going to be very difficult in the 2009-2011 time frame. But the board lays out a two-phase approach. One would be to, if fiscal resources were available, to expand the Oregon Health Plan to its original vision, particularly starting with kids and adults under 100%. And lays out a plan for a phase two in subsequent years based upon two things, really bending the cost curve for sustainability and finding a revenue source to provide coverage for working families and individuals who are employed by non-offering in, employers. The bulk of after the expansion section, the rest of the report really focuses on what the board's position is that our system of healthcare delivery is substantially broken, and that we need to begin to transform and redesign the system, primarily using a lot of incentives, but also having kind of a new and robust reporting and measuring and reporting of setting standards of collecting information and being able to portray where Oregon is as a state, but more importantly where various communities are in the effectiveness of their health systems. Looking at public health outcomes, real tough. A series of recommendations around the state as a major purchaser about setting contract standards that help move system transformation. These would be contract standards in things like quality outcomes and areas like that. A number of areas in a building block that we call stimulate system innovation and improvement. New models of care. The delivery committee of the board and the board spent a lot of time looking at what in some states is called a medical home model. Oregon is referring to it as an integrated health home, as a framework for particularly improving the organization and management of chronic diseases. And we believe that new model of care holds some very real promises. It's an emerging concept. You ask somebody what's an integrated health home, and there are probably 14 different definitions of it. But we know that there are essential prerequisites. And Dr. Chuck Hoffman, who was a member of the board, in essence has over the years changed his practice to simulate a lot of the prerequisites in an integrated health home: electronic medical record, open access appointments, open access meaning that you can get in the same day when you call your doctor, having a team approach using nurse practitioners, physician assistants, nurses, medical assistants, particularly focusing on the management of those with chronic disease where you have outreach to them, not waiting for them to come to the office, using email and telephone, follow-up, group appointments, group education approaches. Heard a number of things that this is happening, not just in physical health, but in mental health. And many of the recommendations focus on how the state can, particularly through the Oregon Health Plan, begin to incent the creation of these integrated health homes, with a very strong recommendation that the Public Employee Benefit Board and the Oregon Employee Benefit, or the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, and other private sector purchasers really investigate how we can help stimulate the creation of this new model of primary care. It's not limited to primary care. There are a number of specialties that can organize themselves around the management of chronic diseases. And simultaneously with this, or next to this recommendation, the board also believes that there's a lot of exciting work going on in some communities through the closer integration of behavioral health with physical health, the co-location of behavioral health clinicians in physical health clinics, or vice versa, of beginning to really stimulate that closer integration of care, particularly in the Oregon Health Plan. We have the three-part contracting approach. I'm sorry, I would owe somebody money if there was a pig up there. End-of-life care, we looked real hard at an approach that has been developed through the Center for Ethics at OHSU, around the physician order for life-sustaining treatment. The acronym is POLST, and the development of a registry so that first responders, mm-hmm. EMTs, and other first responders would be aware if a patient in distress has a POLST form, and that form, in essence, is a legal medical order to the caregiver of what kind of care to provide. So there'll be some recommendations around that. There's a lot of excitement, notwithstanding kind of the tough times we're in and perhaps have been in, there's a lot of interesting community collaboration going on across the state, and the board has learned about that and really recommends to the legislature to look hard at how we can, as a state, incent community collaboration. There's kind of an underlying theory of change that the board has, is that all healthcare is local, and that really to transform a local healthcare system, it's going to happen at the local level. National policy and state policy can help shape it, but what happens at the local level is critical. And we've looked at a number of communities. The Lane County has a 100% access coalition. There's a community collaborative in Deschutes and Jefferson and Crook County. Looking at how you bring social services, private health care providers, the Oregon Health Plan contracting organizations, and get them all around a table and really plan about how to do things better at the community level. So there's a series of recommendations there. A series of recommendations in public health. The takeaway, and I don't think it's new to this committee, is that particularly in the area of childhood obesity, nutrition, and activity, we have a crisis. And its implications over the next decade or two, if not tackled on a public health, community-based public health approach, is really quite sobering as far as the early onset of diabetes and other chronic diseases that young kids in the ages of 8, 9, 10, 11 are going to confront. And we don't have, the board doesn't have a plan per se, but has worked indirectly with the public health division on what we're calling a community-centered health initiative. And to really do something at the community level that's broader than the local public health, that involves schools, churches, employers, et cetera, to tackle the obesity problem generally, but particularly childhood obesity, with a program that's almost like the tobacco cessation that we started 20 or 30 years ago that really changed the generation. I remember my kids mm-hmm. at 6 or 8 coming home and learning about the problems of tobacco and telling me about it directly. But we did change perception and behavior. And I think there's a lot that can be done there. The one area I want to I misspoke, Senator Cruz. The one area that we and it was an oversight. The draft report, we did not talk about medical liability or tort reform. Senate Bill 329 actually said that was one of the areas for the board to work on. And I will tell you, just by time and resource and probably temerity, we didn't take that
temerity.
On. Because it probably could have taken a whole year and a half just for that single issue. But we do call out that the area of medical liability is a strategic issue that ultimately needs to be adequately resolved among the stakeholders in a reformed area, and primarily because of, well, first of all, many people call it a lottery as far as actually getting rewards to those who have been harmed in the medical system. But equally, if not more important, the cost of defensive medicine is exceedingly high. And there's a lot in here about you and improving evidence-based medicine and using information to do that, but simultaneously the board is saying there needs to be a forum. They're recommending that if an authority was created, that it have some sort of council, a medical liability council that would bring the trial bar and healthcare providers and other interested and try to craft some really long-term solutions that they could deliver to the legislature.
Barney, I'd suggest that's almost a front-end issue to any significant long-term reforms. Quite simply, if we're going to go to a preventative model and we're going to allow the decisions to, I mean, you know, one of our big issues right now is we don't have enough providers.
Right.
And if you're OB, you're doing OB in Baker City, they aren't having enough babies for you to actually be able to pay your liability insurance. I mean, that, you know, just a small example. And we point out
in the report those things that, I mean, and I guess there's a certain, it's somewhat ironic, many of us, probably all of us that are here this morning, have been through at least probably three iterations of the medical malpractice
right.
crisis. And not only is the defensive medicine, but we also call out in the report exactly what you're pointing out, Senator Cruz, and that is in some areas of the state where provider access is constrained, we've seen family practice drop the delivery of babies, and those are many times communities where you'll never get an OB there to begin with because the fertility rate isn't high enough. But if an FP stops delivering babies, then there's real implications about travel and prenatal care access and all of these.
Well, Madam Chair, that's kind of the whole thing. I mean, you know, they can go to the hospitals and they'll deliver the babies, but they aren't having the prenatal care.
Right.
They're not having all of the front-end things that are absolutely necessary to make sure we're having healthy kids to start with. So, I mean, it's in my opinion, that's one of the more critical issues we have to tackle.
And there are a number of what one could say really strategic issues that are called out in the comprehensive plan that the legislature in collaboration with the executive branch and the private sector need to focus on. But let me do a segue to one that you mentioned, because the healthcare workforce is called out as we do not have in the recommendations kind of a set of comprehensive recommendations of how to solve it. The kind of the first The first issue we raise is the state needs a 21st century healthcare workforce strategy. And to build that strategy, we're going to need better information about our current healthcare workforce. And I know that there's a number of activities going on. I saw your agenda. I know that Senator Morse has been interested in this, and I think there will be some bills about getting more information from licensing boards. The board supports that of having reliable data. We need to also think, we need to look and have a conversation with the appropriate stakeholders about what really do we need in a 21st century workforce. There's some very strong opinions is that, you know, the model of a single patient seeing a single doctor, we can't train enough doctors. We may have to rethink team-based care, new categories of licensure, et cetera. So thinking about those long-term needs in the sense of a new system of care. And then equally important is the whole issue of working with the training institutions about the capacity they have, the public policy at the state level and at the federal level of helping students with loans and loan repayments, particularly using some incentives around in primary care. And our Federal Laws Committee report also emphasizes the workforce issue from a federal policy. So that this combination of workforce, the medical liability issues, and then one of the other big building blocks of reform is really building a strategy, a state policy strategy for health information technology, of how do we increase the speed of adoption of electronic medical records, but also equally important, in fact maybe more important, is how do we make certain at a community level, if we had every provider wired, if you will, in a digital sense, that they can move information around, that it's interoperable, that it really can move information, not unlike how banks move information from ATMs and things like that. So we've got a series of recommendations. Those recommendations were actually developed by the Governor's Health Information Infrastructure Advisory Committee, which the Governor created a few months after the board got started. And so they did a lot of work on that, and they have brought together a number of people who are really experts in health information technology, also from both the clinical side, but also from the technology side. As I indicated at one of your meetings, that we did have a Federal Laws Committee as called out in Senate Bill 329. They actually met their final meeting was just a week before the board finalized, because they wanted to meet one last time to see what the draft report looked like, so that the recommendations on federal policy squared with this. The recommendations of the Federal Laws Committee will go directly from the Federal Laws Committee to our congressional delegation, but will also be included in our report. We looked at a number of federal policy areas, but the areas that the Federal Laws Committee really stressed as far as strategic federal policies, the first one is Medicare reimbursement. And in the traditional Medicare program. And there's a series of recommendations. We looked at some recommendations out of the Commonwealth Fund about how federal policy could change. Representatives Blumenauer and Hooley had a bill in Congress. But really looking at what we call the low reimbursement states is that this one-size-fits-all approach to the annual or biennial caps on Medicare reimbursement growth have to change, because as you all probably know, in many communities, and I've actually heard it's now in Portland, in most communities, it's not a stretch to say that persons with traditional Medicare are having a very difficult time finding physicians, particularly primary care physicians. A little anecdote, an aside, this is particularly true in Central Oregon, is that I was told, someone told me that an elderly couple or a Medicare eligible couple, I don't know how old they were buying a house in Deschutes County, and in their earnest money agreement, one of the conditions would be that they would have to be able to find a physician who could accept them as Medicare eligibles, or they wouldn't buy the house. Now, I thought there's a very informed,
very telling.
As it turned out, they did find a doctor, so the sale closed. But I mean, it's just one kind of indicator of the nature, the level of concern that people have relative to that access. Let me think about I think that's the overview. I would say that people have, you know, asked me, look at the reality, Barney. Do you really think we can do anything in 2009? And my answer, perhaps, I don't believe it's naive, but I think for a very modest amount of money, we can put some of the building blocks in place. And we've the Office of Health Policy and Research and the staff of the board have put together about a $5 million request to the governor. I don't know whether it's going to be in the governor's, but to build an all-payer claims database, to work more on evidence-based care, to work on the workforce strategy, developing the workforce strategy. I think, and I know that in what you're going to confront in 09-11 relative to dollars, that $5 million is going to be precious. But I also think that is a time that we can begin to make some investments that do have long-term value add over time. And I hope that we can find our way clear to do that. The other thing I would say is that the world is different than when we started. I still believe, and there's lots of parts of the report that are going to be controversial and will be debated, and we understand that. It's the work of seven citizens, handing it over to you. But I do think it does give a framework of thinking about the future, particularly when we get the economy back on track. I also think it provides some value. We don't know what's going to happen federally. But a lot of what I hear being talked about federally, it's still going to be a major role for the states in policy implementation. I think the issues around cost containment and system transformation are going to be as real, whether it's a Wyden-type bill or something else. And so this does set a conceptual and policy recommendation framework for that kind of work. It's been hard. It's been hard work. We had a great staff, and I'm very confident that the people that work with Dr. Janine Smith and Tina Edlin over at OHPR, the young health policy folks, incredibly smart, incredibly hardworking. As I said in my letter to the governor when I resigned, is that the state of Oregon and you in the legislature can look to a very competent group of folks to tell you what's the best that the health research can tell us today. Without them, this wouldn't have been done. I'll stop there. I appreciate the opportunity that the governor has given me. And tomorrow at 5 o'clock, I go on vacation for a couple of weeks, and then I'm done. So.
How nice. Well, first of all, on behalf of the committee, we really want to thank you and the Oregon Health Fund Board for what you have done and what you have put before us. And I know that Senator Gormley wasn't here, and she actually said, please, besides Barney and the Health Fund Board, she especially wants to also thank Marcus Mundy, Tricia Tillman, and really appreciates the meaningful attention paid to health disparity issues and comments. So she wanted to make sure that got on the record.
Let me give a minute or two for the record, because I appreciate Senator Gordley raising that. I'm very proud that when you read 329, there were almost intuitively five committees, something on finance, something on delivery, et cetera. The board, at its first meeting on its own initiative, created a health equities committee to look at health disparities. It was chaired by Dr. Ella Booth from the Center of Health Ethics at OHSU, and had something like 15 people representing community action agencies dealing with people of color, ethnicity, rural isolation, disabilities, et cetera, a very exciting committee. They made a series of recommendations. They are both, those recommendations are inserted in the report in the topical areas that they relate to and then also called out very separately. Marcus Mundy, who is the CEO of the Urban League of Portland, is on the board. And Marcus makes in both the sense of the workforce, but greater health care transformation is that the face, as he says it, this is not a quote, but the face of Oregon is changing. and in the next 10 or 15 years relative to ethnic diversity, racial diversity, et cetera, we're going to be a different state than we've historically been. And our healthcare system needs to be able to adapt to that, both in the kind of workforce we have, culturally sensitive healthcare, culturally knowledgeable healthcare, but also in looking real hard at these numbers where we have disparities and to undertake strategies to eliminate those. And I think the report has some really good contributions in that area.
Great. I just would like your input on, I'm still worried about the cost containment issue because we are an acute care system. I mean, we pay for actual services, and that's how hospitals make money, and that's how the physicians make their money. I just finished reading a report on evidence-based maternity care. It's, you know, about that thick, that was published by the Reforming State Groups. It's Milbank Foundation sponsored. And in there were some very controversial, I think, issues that especially physicians would be very much opposed to, but it did show how we can save money by using different modalities in, say, let's just focus on maternity care. So, like induced labor, there, and the use of epidurals, there's actual outcomes are showing that those that have induced labor and use of epidurals can be harmful long term in how the mother produces the natural processes of her hormones or, you know, chemicals that are needed to go through their process. And the outcomes in birth centers and the use of midwives of babies are far better than those by use of the physicians. So that type of information needs to be vetted and needs to be... So where would the health policy, the health, this evidence-based, I'm still looking at cost containment, where would something like that be vetted and brought out as evidence-based
our healthcare. Recommendations, Senator, Madam Chair, are that we use two existing commissions that have a fair degree of experience in these areas. One would be the Oregon Health Resources Commission, which was chartered back when the Oregon Health Plan was framed of looking at medical technology.
So the health authority isn't going to replace...
No, they would see that these commissions would work with the health authority under the guidance of the health authority, and also the Health Services Commission that's, while primarily looking at the prioritized lists, they have also looked at best practices and evidence-based about services on those lists. So I think we have a framework in government of how to do this, and what we're recommending is that we use those entities and broaden the involvement of what I like to call is get the best of healthcare, the best of medicine from the private sector involved in this, and start with some issues where you can build consensus.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a model that Minnesota's used, and I can't remember the name of it right now. It's a kind of a public-private partnership, brings together the Mayo Clinic, Health Partners, the major carriers, the university, and they look at both technology and evidence-based practices and develop consensus, and then they all agree to it. And it's that collaboration and looking at this kind of information that begins to change mm-hmm. practice styles. I saw it when I was a very young man with a debate about, and you'll remember this, I think, Senator, the length of hospital care for cataract surgery
right.
20 years ago was three to four days with sandbags beside the head.
That's 3 to 4 weeks.
Well, I mean, it was long.
It was long.
And now
yeah.
it's done on an
one
outpatient
day.
Basis
yeah.
In many cases. And there was great controversy in this state, but particularly in Portland, between programs like Kaiser Permanente that was using evidence-based care about mm-hmm. how to do cataracts in a more with quality being equal or superior and the cost inputs being less. But we had to work through that evidence to begin to change.
It's going
to
be tough because, well, like in Arizona, they're implementing some of this evidence-based maternity care. And they, one hospital took a loss of $368,000, which was significant, but they were implementing the evidence-based practices. They were getting better outcomes, but it's the hospital saying to us, it really, you know, is tough because they're losing money.
Right.
Well,
the other part of this, then we have some recommendations, and there's already some kind of voluntary work going on in the state, and that is payment reform. Because there are a number of examples of that. There was an example in Bellingham, Washington, where they did some work over 2 years, really improved the care. A lot of it was moved to the ambulatory sector, but the hospital, you know, was in financial distress because of this improvement. We have to find ways to, at a community level, begin to pay to recognize that we're changing the practice style, therefore the method of payment has to change. A lot of work going on at the federal government. We didn't have enough time, but everybody seems to agree that payment reform is an essential part to address exactly what you're saying and also to speed up that implementation.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at things like case management in the area of the medical home, adding case management fees for some of the new costs that would be bundle payments for certain kinds of conditions that involve both outpatient and inpatient care.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the next 10 years is going to be really quite exciting as we try to find new reimbursement approaches that address kind of new delivery strategies.
Yeah.
And
I made a mistake. It's not Arizona, it's Utah.
And reward. What we want to do, and the board's basically saying, we want to incent and reward innovation that improves quality. The board believes, and we've looked at some models of a county in Sweden where they've held their costs 3% a year increase by basically using total quality management concepts from the United States in healthcare. And we believe that quality improvement is not incompatible with cost containment. In fact, they go together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree. Totally.
Thank you again.
Well, thank you. Any comments?
Well, we won't be able to begin the session if Barney's not going to be here because Barney's always here. So,
I was thinking, golly, maybe you didn't like the report, so that's not why you're coming back.
I'm just tired, ma'am.
Yeah, I can understand that. Madam Chair, this is thought-provoking. I am beginning the process of diving into the 170-plus pages, and hopefully we'll have familiarized myself significantly with it before January. There's some things in here that I find interesting and thought-provoking, and with some potential, there's some things in here that scare the hell out of me. So, to be quite blunt, and I also know that I have not seen Representative Greenlick's package yet.
Oh, yes, I want to mention that. Yeah.
It's not out yet. I'm assuming it's partially based on this, but probably Mitch's own version. And
well, I can't comment. I have seen a what I would call a narrative outline of it. I think it essentially, if I get this wrong, I'll apologize to Representative Greenlight. I think it essentially tries to capture all the major recommendations in the report that require legislation. There may be a couple of areas where I would call some Greenlick flourishes may have been added.
What a shock.
But it does that. I would also say that through the Office of Health Policy and Research, the Oregon Health Fund Board, and DHS, I think we have six LCs that will address several of these issues also, not in in a kind of a compendium, but things like the all-payer claims database and evidence-based medicine and things like that. Yeah. So I think we'll have appropriate vehicles for the discussion.
Yeah. Well, just for the record, too, I've taken a back seat to this because Representative Green has been very vocal and aggressive in wanting all of the health fund board LCs bills to start in on the House side in his committee, which is fine with me. They can start that. My fear is that if they get bogged down, we are going to get it last minute and have to rush something through, which we will not. So I think that we are going to be monitoring very closely those LCs, right, or the bills, right from the very beginning. And if we see they're getting bogged down, we can just go forward and produce what we feel might go through. Because we do need health care reform. We do need to have at least a first step into a long range
Madam Chair, I mean, and I agree with you, and we will watch with interest what the House does. The House is going to be a very interesting dynamic, especially because they have 18 new members this time. But
18 new members.
But what I don't want to lose, I mean, we may need to pick up, you know, the electronic records piece is something Senator Morissette and I have been after for a long time, and it is time. And so there's some of the stuff that we may need to pick off and move separately from the other concept, because there is a potential that this thing could get bogged down.
And we don't want it to. They say there's advantages into having one omnibus bill, and then there's advantages to having separate bills. So we'll see.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, just for the record, I do have the outline that Barney mentioned. I will email it to the entire committee. You can look at it. And then, for the record, it is Representative Greenlick's hope to, on December 9th, have just a work session to pre-session to introduce that LC as a committee bill.
Great.
And then even before that, I will email. But apparently it is going to be a behemoth LC, 200 plus pages.
Yeah.
So you might be getting it in two or three chapters as an email attachment. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, and that's fine. And I applaud Mitch for wanting to take this issue on. But there are some, like I said, there's some pieces here I have real problems with. But there are some pieces here, and I think you spoke to Barney, that we can move on now. And we clearly need to make sure that those don't get lost in.
I hope where there's both bicameral and bipartisan support on what I would call some of these strategic issues, that they don't get lost. Because we know there's a lot of potential controversy, and I think a good comprehensive plan ought to have enough in it to make everybody a little angry, and then find out where the truth lies.
But like, well, Barney, you told me a few months ago that big picture, this is a long-term plan. It's going to take years to do, and I agree with that, whichever way we end up going. But like I said, some of these pieces we need to make sure happen.
Right.
So.
Good. Thank you again.
Thank
Happy
you.
Holidays.
You bet. Same to you. All right. Have a good rest. All right. With that, I'd like to close the informational session on the Oregon Health Plan. Oregon Health Fund Board, and now open for public comment, but I don't think anyone signed up. Does anyone out there want to give some public comment? If not, thank you, committee, so very much, and our next meeting will be during session, and just to let you know, I want, of course, I haven't even been considered. I've been told that I'm going to be chair of the health policy, but it isn't out yet, we're going to have one of our first meetings at an ambulatory surgical center in Portland area, and we'll probably have our workforce topic probably there then, the first go-around on workforce in Portland. Okay. Any other comments? All right. We're adjourned. Thank you.